good as this last one.
Talk Shoe.
Recorded live.
Okay, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here, and we're going to have a discussion about the two-seed line philosophy or theory or hypothesis, whatever doctrine, whatever word you want to choose. And this is Christogenos, and we're going to be starting a series on two-seed line doctrine. And, you know, as soon as Bill calls in, I'm going to, you know, ask him basically to, you know, give his overview of what he feels the two-seed line perspective is. And, you know, I will do that right now. And from my perspective, it all goes back to Genesis chapter 3, in which we have, I have to click on Bill's phone here. Okay, dialed in. Let me try again, Bill. There we go. All right. Okay, you there, Bill?
Yes. Hello, Eli.
Excellent. Okay. And I was just about to say that from the Genesis chapter 3, the pregnancy that Eve had, which is not actually documented as a pregnancy until Genesis 4:1. But when you read through Genesis chapter 3, just about all of those words, like tree means family tree, doesn't mean literal tree, and the punishments that Eve received for her sin. And, of course, Adam joined in that sin after she was beguiled, and that's the word used in the King James, beguiled. And they were given loincloths and to wear, and not dunce caps or not face masks or anything like that. They were given loincloths to cover their shame, okay? And the loincloth is used to cover your genital areas, not for your mind or for your mouth. And Eve's reproductive capacity was cursed as well. That's later on in chapter 3. So there's numerous clues in Genesis chapter 3 that what was going on there is a seduction, a physical sexual seduction, and that Eve actually produced two different kinds of offspring, much the same as the Esau-Jacob scenario, but in this case, much the different kinds are much more radically different, in that Cain actually had a different father from Adam, okay? That's my perspective of the two-seed line doctrine. And, you know, we can get into that and start discussing the Hebrew. You know, we'll start from Genesis chapter 1. Bill, do you want to give us your synopsis of, you know, what you mean by two-seed line?
Yes, it's not only what I mean by two-seed line, it's what I mean by Christian identity.
Okay.
The To me, Christian identity is two-seed line.
Okay, yeah, it is for me too.
And any version of Christian identity without two-seed line is a lie. It's lying to itself because it's not properly identifying the parties of the Bible,
right?
The parties of Scripture.
Mm-hmm.
And we seek not only to identify who Israel is in the world, but who are the serpents and the scorpions.
Okay.
For instance, in Luke 10:18-20, Yahshua Christ, he says to his disciples, "I beheld Satan as lightning fall from heaven."
Right.
Satan is the adversary.
Yes.
Or the enemy.
Yes.
"Behold, I give unto you power to tread on serpents and scorpions."
Mm-hmm.
Now, he's not changing the subject.
Right.
These are two very closely linked statements.
So that serpent is not one of those that crawls around on the ground.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
We're not going to start speaking in tongues and casting snakes around a campfire.
Right. Right, and Eve wasn't sitting on her tuffet when a snake crawled up beside her and started talking to her. Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
these are
exactly.
Two-legged metaphoric serpents and two-legged metaphorical scorpions.
Yeah, it's metaphorical language, just as in Matthew chapter 15 when Yahshua is confronted by the Canaanite woman. And he says, "It is not appropriate to give the children's bread to the dogs." okay, by which he meant her. And she said, yes, I understand what you're saying, but I'm happy to take crumbs. that which falls from the table. And
well,
then,
right. But she was identified as a dog.
Yes.
The Canaanite woman was identified as a dog on site.
Mm-hmm.
The apostles tried to chase her away.
Right.
That's something that you would hardly do to a prospective Christian.
Right. Exactly.
They were yeah. never reprimanded for trying to beat her off, basically.
Yes.
And it's under the yeah. power of the dog, as we see in the Psalms, and Clifton Emmaheiser just wrote about this topic,
okay.
that the crucifixion, that Yahshua Christ was to die
yes.
by the power of the dog.
Uh-huh, interesting.
And it's a clear link in the Psalms to the dog people or the Canaanites.
Right. And also in Revelation 21 and 22, it says, outside of the kingdom are dogs, okay?
Right. Well, there's no dogs in the kingdom. That's right.
That's, right.
That's, and,
right.
And the churchianity tries to say that a dog is a – and I've honestly seen this in grown men's commentaries. I mean scholarly commentaries. They're trying to say that a dog is a male prostitute.
Right.
And it is true in one particular instance in the Old Testament – that male prostitutes are likened to dogs.
Okay.
But the Canaanite woman couldn't have been a male prostitute.
That's right. That's right.
and it wasn't a bunch of male prostitutes that were crucifying Christ.
That's right.
That's
although some of them may have been. Yeah.
It may have been Psalm 2.
Uh-huh.
Psalm 2 or Psalm 22. I'm sorry, my memory's faulty.
Yeah. I do have one of Yahweh's chosen. It's called, and I'm going to unmute to see if that person has. Hello, are you there? That person may just call in to listen. Sometimes people.
Okay. Well, my point is the two seed line, it has to start before Genesis chapter 3.
Yes.
We have to define it by going to a period of time of pre-Adamic history that is very sketchy to us, that we can't say for sure what happened, but we have a clear outline in Scripture in symbols of what happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes, for sure.
And that is when two seed line starts, because the serpent is not a snake, and it's already in the garden.
Right.
It's the tree in the midst of the garden.
Okay.
Genesis chapter 3 is a parable.
Mm-hmm.
It's a parable. It's written in symbols.
That's
nothing
right.
in Genesis chapter 3 is to be taken absolutely literally.
Mm-hmm.
However, there is language, and I wrote this about in a paper called Shemitic Idioms in Genesis chapter 3. There's language that informs us, and it's also what you pointed out about the loincloth
mm-hmm.
and the pain in childbirth and things like that.
Right.
But there's other language about understanding and wisdom and becoming like a god
okay.
that is repeated elsewhere in, if I have to use the term, Semitic culture.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And meaning Semites meaning white people and not Jews
right.
and Arabs.
Exactly. Exactly.
The Assyrians wrote this, the legend of the Epic of Gilgamesh. And in Gilgamesh, one of the giants, Enkidu, has sex with a woman, and she tells him that now he has understanding,
mm-hmm.
and that now he's like a god.
Mm-hmm.
They are idioms used of sexual awakening.
Okay.
It's absolutely clear from the Epic of Gilgamesh, which was being copied and distributed amongst Shemitic-speaking peoples at the same exact time that Moses was writing the books of the Pentateuch,
right.
the book of Genesis, and they used the same idioms in Genesis
right.
that were being used already in their own culture,
yes.
In their own broader cultural context.
Yeah, and those nations of Genesis 10, they were all descended from Adamites anyway, to begin with. They were all descended
from... Yes, absolutely. And the Assyrians who used this were fellow Shemites of the Hebrews.
Right. Right. And after the confusion of language, that's when we had, the story started to diverge a bit. But we could say that let's call it mythology, for lack of a better word. The mythology is distinctly Hebrew slash Adamite/Sethite in origin, isn't it?
I mean, absolutely. The mythology, all right, I could go into, if you read, I read 3 years ago, and I can't absorb half of what I wanted to in one reading. I have to read it again to be honest.
Oh, sure.
James Pritchard, Ancient Near Eastern Texts Relating to the Old Testament. It's an entire collection of texts which they feel, this is the scholars at Princeton, feel that relate to the Old Testament. You can know there are so many Egyptian and Babylonian and Sumerian and Assyrian texts that have been uncovered by archaeologists that you can't possibly publish them in any one volume.
Mm-hmm.
So he selected a collection of texts from each of these ancient cultures, all of them at least as old as the time of David, and many of these texts are much older than the time of Abraham. Now, I mean, some of these texts date back to 2500 B.C.
Okay.
And we know that from their archaeological context.
Yes, yes.
And these texts all have stories about serpents and earth gods,
mm-hmm.
about the underworld being a place for the rebellious.
Yes.
The Akkadian death god is portrayed, Akkadian is the name of the Assyrian language, it's Akkad, Sumer and Akkad.
Okay.
Were two districts in Babylonia. The Akkadian death god has the head of a serpent dragon. It's described, and he rules over the underworld.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's a whole collection. The dragon is a rebel in Egypt. The dragon, there's a story in Egyptian mythology about the dragon destroying the sun, which is a symbol of godly power.
Right, right.
This is all over. If you read Revelations chapter 12, verse 7, this is all over ancient mythology. These stories. It's all Sethite in origin, and it's
yes, I agree.
It's laced throughout the context of the ancient world.
Yeah, now it's interesting that in China they worship the dragon.
Yes, in pre-Adamic cultures, the Oriental people, as we know them, their skeletons and remains date back much further than the mm-hmm. remains of Caucasian people, of Adamic people.
Okay.
Adam is the end of the Genesis 1 creation.
Okay.
But something corrupted that creation before Adam. Before the arrival of Adam, something had corrupted the prior creation.
Okay.
We can't get that story except in glimpses from the Bible. We have to turn to what we know from anthropology and archaeology and from our own historical consciousness.
Yes. And from what we know of our many and numerous discussions against race mixing the last few shows, it's very obvious that Adam kind is not supposed to mix with the other kinds. And, so it would be contradictory, for example, as many people believe, that all races to be descended from Adam and Eve, when then right away forbidding race mixing of the various products of Adam and Eve. It's much more intelligent, and of course, the archaeological record shows that all these races coexisted side by side for millennia, okay? And so that, and they stayed separate during those millennia, okay? And it's just a matter of tracing skeletons into the ancient past that proves this, And so why should we start race mixing now when the Bible clearly forbids it? This doesn't make any sense. And, the other scenario that a lot of people believe is that Ham was black, Shem was white, and Japheth was Oriental. And nothing of the kind is true. They were all three were white. They had one white father and one white mother, period. All right?
I have a paper on my website, the Race of Genesis 10,
mm-hmm.
which goes, I mean, when I wrote the paper, my access to various tools and resources was quite limited, as you well know.
Mm-hmm.
However, I go as far as I can from classical histories and with archaeological evidence to show that all of those nations of Genesis chapter 10 were white people.
Right.
Every one of them.
Right.
The Ethiopians, it can be shown in early Greek history. Memnon, the Ethiopian, in Hesiod, who wrote about 600 BC, Memnon the Ethiopian built Susa.
Mm-hmm.
Susa is the capital city of Persia.
Yes.
We all know that Susa has always been, in our historical recollection, an Aryan city.
Right.
The Persians are an Aryan people. So if the Greeks said that an Ethiopian named Memnon, who also fought in the Trojan War, according to certain Greek
mm-hmm.
poems,
okay.
built Susa, how could we assume that that might be a black person?
Right.
Or one of the types of Ethiopians that we know today.
Well, certainly when the white race went down into the heart of darkest Africa, there weren't any reading, writing, arithmetic, blacks in Africa at the time. If there was an uprising or a period during which the Egyptian pharaohs had declined, it's possible then, I think the biblical term is Nubians, blacks, and usually those blacks were mixed with a lot of white blood. They had maybe invaded Egypt and taken over for a while, okay? But there's certainly in the heart of darkest Africa, no Negroes had ever become pharaohs. There's nothing like that in the archaeological record. Nefertiti, for example, you just look at her face, the bust of her face, she's white. And mummies, the oldest mummies are all Nordic in appearance, with red hair, blonde hair, brown hair, and blue eyes, et cetera, okay?
Absolutely. Lapis lazuli is always used to make the eyes of the pharaoh. It's not always, but very often.
Very often, yes.
And lapis lazuli is blue.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
The older you get in Egyptian archaeology, the more Aryan the people are.
Right.
No doubt. I've seen blue-eyed and red-headed and blonde-headed
mm-hmm.
remains and portraits of people all throughout from the first dynasty
right.
forward, fifth dynasty,
yeah.
sixth dynasty. It's all there if you go back to
yeah.
the really old stuff. The Black Africa happened in the 7th century B.C. when the Nubians overran Black Egypt happened in the 7th century B.C. when the Nubians overran it.
Right, right.
And they held it for 50 years. They held it totally.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Until the Egyptians wrested their own government back. But 50 years,
yes.
a lot of damage occurs. And the people that we have in Egypt today are a bastardized people.
That's right.
The Egyptians of later Greek times, of Ptolemaic times, the Ptolemies came to Egypt, and Egypt achieved a higher level of culture again.
Mm-hmm.
And that was wholly Greek,
right.
that culture. And those Greeks had adopted a lot of things that were considered in vogue because they were ancient and they were Egyptian, and Egypt had such a long history and a greatly
right.
notable name. They adopted a lot of their culture, but the Alexandrian Egypt was an entirely Greek culture.
That's right. Yeah, well, Cleopatra was a Greek, and her predecessors were Greeks. The whole Ptolemaic pharaonic line, I assume they're all Greeks, yes.
Right, but the Egyptian natives of that time were already a bastardized people.
Yes. Yeah.
And Strabo, to contrast the Greek world with the Egyptian world, Strabo, the geographer who died in 25 AD, he wrote an account, a geography of the entire world known to the Greeks at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And he marveled that in Egypt, people of multiple races inhabited the same city.
Mm-hmm.
Something that didn't happen in the Near East or
right.
in the Greek world.
Right, and it didn't happen in Europe until around 1950.
Yeah, well, that's exactly true.
Yes. You know, we've had 2,000, 3,000, 5,000, 6,000 years and more of racial segregation. Why is it all of a sudden supposed to be good? Of course, you can see what's happening in South Africa today with black rule and integration having taken over there. Those societies are totally collapsing as a result. But let me get back to the issue of the two separate seed lines and bloodlines. Bloodlines is a good word for it, too. Now, I know that Charles Wiseman, who opposes the two seed line doctrine, he admits, however, that we we cannot have Jesus Christ, Yahshua Messiah, coming through the line of Judah unless he is a pure Adamite. He concedes that point, okay? And so Luke chapter 3 gives that bloodline from Yahweh to Adam to Seth to Enoch all the way down to Yahshua Messiah, okay? And he concedes that that's right and proper. What he doesn't want to admit is that Eve had a pregnancy via someone other than Adam, okay? So some of these non-seedliners are really close to two seedliners without, you know, they just don't want to admit that Eve had a pregnancy by another humanoid or another human being, okay? So now how do you see it? I'm sure in your opinion, Eve had a dual pregnancy.
Well, you know, the Greeks have a myth concerning Heracles.
Okay.
That his mother had sex with both Zeus and with an earthbound man and had a dual pregnancy. And Heracles had a brother who was immortal because he was the father of the man, and Heracles was a god because he was the father of Zeus, the son of Zeus.
Okay.
I'm citing this only to show that this idea existed in the ancient world.
Right.
And this can be found in Works and Days. It's in Hesiod, this myth that I'm citing.
Yes, yes.
And it's in Works and Days, which is one of his poems.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm sorry. It's in the poem Shield of Heracles.
All right.
Lines 30 through 55.
Okay. You got
it,
sir?
It's a perfect parallel to what I believe is the Cain and Abel story.
Right.
And Genesis 4:1 is a corrupt verse.
Okay.
If you go to the Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible, and that's one mainstream source that'll tell you that there is a gloss in Genesis 4:1, that the Hebrew is grammatically imperfect.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that you've tried to interpret Genesis 4:1 on the face of what the Hebrew says.
Right.
As we know the Hebrew today. And while I admire that attempt, and I'm not going to dismiss it in any way, to me, I can't even translate Genesis 4:1.
Okay,
it's a corrupt verse. I'm not going to translate it.
So are you saying,
point to the context of the Bible, the rest of the New Testament, Yahshua Christ, in Luke chapter 11, I think it's from verse 48 or 49 forward, he tells the Jews or the non-believing, the adversarial Judeans of his day, he tells them that they're the descendants of the devil and the descendants of Cain.
Right.
And there's no taking that for anything but what it says, especially when you put it together with John 8:44, with the evidence in Jude, the statements in Revelation. When you put all that together, you can't take Genesis 4:1, which is a corrupt verse, and somehow unravel it all.
So now that reference that you cited, what are they saying, that there's words missing or that grammatically it doesn't make any sense?
There's several different Aramaic targums. The Aramaic targums, now a lot of people dismiss them right away because they're in the Talmud. Well, not everything in the Talmud is a lie.
Right.
I mean, most of the stuff in the Talmud is evil. I take it. We have to admit that. Just read it.
Mm-hmm.
But not everything in it is a lie. The Aramaic targums are very early and translations or interpretations more so of Scripture, which have been preserved in the Talmud.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that the Aramaic targums are Talmudic in their original origin.
No, they weren't. Exactly.
Because the Bible itself, the Pentateuch itself, has been preserved in Talmud.
Right, right. Well, here's let me just interrupt, if you don't mind. Here's my understanding of what the targums are. The targums are simply the Aramaic translations from the Hebrew that were begun to be read in the synagogue, in the Judahite synagogue of the house
of
Judah. Not Jews, not by Jews. The Jews had nothing to do with writing the Aramaic targums.
Well, the original targums. No, they didn't.
Yes. And so consequently, the mere fact that they're in the Talmud does not make them Jewish literature. Okay.
Absolutely. That's the point I'm trying to make in a roundabout way.
Okay.
Now, the Aramaic targums, there are different versions of them because they're different interpretations of the Hebrew into Aramaic. And there are multiple Aramaic targums which say that Cain was the son of a union with Eve and Satan.
Mm-hmm.
And this information is on both Israel Elect, and it's on emmaheiser.christogenia.org in a paper that Clifton Emmaheiser wrote, The Problem with Genesis 4:1. And he quotes the Aramaic targums and he explains them. And they fill in the missing words, or they attempt to fill in the missing words of Genesis 4:1. Or what was believed to be by early Hebrews, the missing words.
Yes.
And they explain that Cain was the union of Eve and the serpent.
Okay. The question on the screen, because we've been talking about Satan and serpent, Rebel Pride says Satan is not a human, but in Genesis chapter 3, the word is Nahash. Nahash being the wise one, the enchanter, the whisperer. There's various different, in one case, that the rudimentary form of Nahash is to shine like brass, meaning it has a reflective light, but not a Shekinah glory light that Adam and Eve had, which would be one of the reasons why Eve might have been fooled, because Nahash had shone like brass, but he didn't have his own light to shine by, okay? What's this word serpent here? And
the serpent in Genesis chapter 3, Nahash, also means an enchanter.
Right.
A deceiver, an enchanter. It's another metaphor.
Yes.
It's not a literal serpent. Eve was not talking to a snake.
Right.
And a lot of otherwise intelligent men have sworn
it was a snake.
He had the power of speech.
A talking snake, yes. Yeah.
And if you go, the definition is in Revelation chapter 12. Satan, the serpent, the dragon, all the same being, all the same entity.
Right. Fallen angels.
Absolutely.
Yes. We're talking about fallen angels here.
I would like to discuss the fallen angels.
Okay.
Really, before we really commence on anything else.
Okay, yeah, because one of the points that's fascinating, before you launch into that, let me a quick point, that we do have fallen angels in Genesis chapter 6, and just about every theologian under the sun admits that, okay? So if there were fallen angels in Genesis chapter 6, why can't there be a fallen angel in Genesis chapter 3, okay?
Absolutely.
That's the only point I want to make. Okay, go ahead.
That's a very good point. They deny it in chapter 3, and they admit it in chapter 6. That's a very valid point.
Mm-hmm.
That they're not measuring with their own ruler. They're being hypocritical.
They're not being consistent. Yes. Okay.
So Joshua Christ in Luke chapter 10, verses 18 to 20, he says that he beheld Satan as lightning fall from heaven.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that happened in the past.
Yes.
And this story does not enter into our culture with Joshua Christ alone here in the New Testament. We don't read about it in the Old Testament, but we see the dragon that fell from heaven and had a war with the gods in Greek mythology.
Mm-hmm.
And there, Typhon is one of them, and Python is the other.
Right.
And they're probably both corruptions of the same story which had been with the race for 3,000 years.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
From the time of Adam almost 5,000 years from the time of Adam until the time that the Greeks started to record these things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's in Hesiod, it's in Strabo, it's in Diodorus Siculus. The best little book is Apollodorus.
Okay.
If you want a good overview of Greek mythology and you're only going to read one ancient Greek poet, read Apollodorus.
Okay.
Because he gives the summary of Apollodorus' library gives the summary of all Greek mythology. And Strabo says that Zeus, who is God or Yahweh to the Greeks, had a battle with Typhon, the giant dragon or serpent, and Typhon went underground in Syria.
Yes, and he's still there.
Yeah.
And Typhon, you switch you switch the P and the T, and you got Python.
Well,
another snake.
Yes. words are very close.
That's right.
In fact, the story with Apollo was that he had a battle with Python and defeated Python, the serpent, at Delphi, and obtained the art of divination from the serpent, which is why Apollo's oracle is at Delphi.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a different Greek myth.
Yes.
I'm bringing up these Greek myths not to show that the pagan religion of the Greeks is valid. It's certainly not.
Mm-hmm.
To show that we could discuss at length that these Greek people, two tribes of the Greeks, the two notable tribes of the Greeks, the Danans and the Dorians, are Israelite tribes that moved to Greece.
Right.
A third tribe, the Ionians, are Japhethites,
mm-hmm.
who descended from Noah also.
Yes.
And my point is to show that these stories have been with our race since the dawn of time.
So, yes.
Wherever we went, we see these stories. If you go to the Norse Eddas, you'll see their world surrounded by the world serpent.
Mm-hmm.
And there's parallels in every Aryan religion with Hebrewism.
Mm-hmm.
They all take their root. All these pagan religions are found in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, but the stories have become expounded on, and because of that, because ancient poetry was a form of entertainment, it was their only entertainment.
Right.
The men made up all kinds of different little side stories and spins on these stories as time progressed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's like the telephone game played over 5,000 years.
Right, right.
So that's why I'm citing all these Greek myths and Akkadian myths and Egyptian myths, because we see the parallels.
Right,
And the parallels don't tell us that the Hebrew story is, or the Bible is not valid. To me, knowing where the people came from, it proves that the Bible is valid.
Yes.
It proves that Scripture is valid.
Oh, yeah, well, the Greek mythology, Roman mythology, all of the Middle Eastern and even the Egyptian mythology, they're all Adamic, based on the Adamic stories.
Absolutely.
So it's Hebrew mythology. That's what it is. Yeah.
The early Germans, the Greeks, the Romans, the Assyrians all had the same stories.
Right, right. And they all come from the same central source, the Hebrews.
Yes, they do.
Yes, yes. Now, of course, the 10 nations of Genesis, I keep on saying 10 nations, it's more than 10, but the nations of Genesis 10, those are all Adamite nations, at least they were when they started out.
Right.
Yeah.
Every one of them was white when it started out, and this can all be discussed. And
okay, yes, yes.
Maybe it should be down the road.
Yeah. Right, yeah, we'll get to that, I think, maybe not today, but later on. One other point before I delve into Genesis chapter 1, because there's so much important stuff in Genesis chapter 1 regarding, you know, for example, kind after kind, which means, you know, breeding according to your own species, okay? But the whole idea of Satan, and there's a lot of people who do not want to admit or even think about two seed line because they assume that there's a lot of no Satan people, even within identity. They believe the Bible, but they don't believe that there's such a thing as Satan, okay? And so what they want to say is, well, two seed line can't be true because there is really no such thing as Satan, and how can a non-existent being get a woman pregnant, okay?
Well, but that's their own perception of Satan. It's at fault.
Right, exactly, yeah. But the point I want to make is that it doesn't matter because all we have to prove is that Eve had sex with somebody else besides Adam. It doesn't even have to be a Satan, okay? It just has to be something like Nahash, who was a humanoid other than Adam, okay? That's all we have to prove. So the Satan equation is not even necessary for two seed line. All we have to prove is that Eve had a dual pregnancy, one by Adam and one by somebody else, okay? So their whole argument that two seed line is no good because we don't believe in Satan is meaningless, okay? All right, so as long as we can show that Eve had sex with somebody besides Adam, you know, it doesn't matter. It simply doesn't matter. We're just trying to be accurate here. This is what you're describing is what the Bible in totality teaches, correct? Isn't that what you're saying?
Absolutely. It's a story that's laced throughout the New Testament.
Right, right. Okay.
And the apocryphal literature.
Right. Oh, yes.
At great length.
Yes, yeah. And I know that Clifton Emmaheiser, in one of his tracts, points out that the early church fathers also taught that Eve was literally seduced, okay, not just mentally seduced. They interpreted that as being literally seduced, okay? So let's go into Genesis chapter 1, because what we want to establish here is that there were other races of beings on this planet before Adam and Eve were placed in the garden, okay? And this is the usual assumption, which is a false assumption, that the garden only had Adam, Eve, and the serpent, okay? Whereas in reality, all of the races were already here on this planet. And we're just talking about the garden specifically with not, you know, any great discussion about who lived outside the garden. Of course, the first question everybody has is, where did Cain get his wife from when he got kicked out of the garden and went into the land of Nod? Okay. And so, well, then they start speculating and saying, well, Eve must have had a daughter. Well, that's not in the Bible. You're making assumptions. Okay. Let's be realistic and let's try to correspond with natural history. Okay. The garden is not the planet. Okay. So there were people living outside the garden. It just makes sense. But let's go.
And first, let me just say that Eden.
Yes.
In Akkadian, the word Eden, and this is throughout ancient Near Eastern texts, throughout the Assyrian or Akkadian inscriptions.
Uh huh.
The word Eden refers to the steppe.
Oh, okay.
That's what Eden means.
Yeah.
And it's translated steppe.
The fertile plain.
And it's plainly the steppe, S-T-E-P-P-E.
Right.
The grassy plains north
right.
of Mesopotamia.
Mm-hmm.
It's plainly the steppe in the context of the texts in many, many cases. It's doubtless. It really can't be disputed once you examine the text.
Right.
And
right.
it's translated steppe throughout Akkadian translations of Akkadian
mm-hmm.
work, such as the Epic of Gilgamesh.
Right. Yeah.
The word is Eden.
Yes. It was a very fertile plain, and the probably so fertile that it was not necessary per se to be farmers, because there was so much food everywhere that you didn't really have to, and the population was not that great yet, that you didn't have to have systematic farming. Okay, agriculture. But, you know, we have kind of what I would call a limited agriculture, in that people could build cities near these fields that were plentiful in food. And as it describes in the garden, you just go to an apple tree and pick an apple, or a peach tree and pick a peach, etc., and just survive off of that without actually cultivating the ground. Okay, is that how you see it?
Well, yeah, I could give a clear example. When I was a young boy in Massachusetts, my aunt used to take us out, and we used to go up and down the roads with baskets picking wild blackberries.
Right.
And she'd make jars of blackberry jam.
Mm-hmm.
And later on in life, those blackberries disappeared.
Right.
She had to go out and buy blackberry bushes.
Yes.
And cultivate her own blackberries. And that's just a parallel. Early man found his grain and his victuals by hunting and gathering.
Right.
By seeking out and finding and gathering.
Yes.
And all of our grains, our rices, our barley, our wheat, they were all originally wild.
Mm-hmm.
We only cultivated them out of necessity.
That's right. That's right. And of course, it was the white race, as commonly everybody understands, who began the activity of farming on a massive scale. And it wasn't done, in fact, even today, you go into the heart of darkest Africa, they're not good farmers. Very few of them know anything about farming. And what they're doing now is they're killing off white farmers, and they're beginning to starve because they don't know how to farm.
Yeah, Zimbabwe 10 years ago was a great grain exporter, and now it's a great grain importer.
That's right.
And they're starving to death. All the grain they import is free.
Yeah. Right.
It's grain, of course, but
right.
We're getting off the topic here.
But no, I just want to point out that it's the white race from whom all of this agriculture has come. And, you know, you can say that the Chinese, they cultivate rice, et cetera, et cetera. But it's the white race that has fed the world through agriculture. And it's no other race, okay?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's just one of those facts that we, you know, we have to understand. But here, let's go into Genesis chapter 1. And, you know, a lot of people believe that there's a, you know, because it's hard to have a one-to-one correlation of, you know, the development of, you know, lower forms of life going up to the highest forms of life. It's hard to say that this Genesis matches that exactly. It's just a general description. So let's go into it. Genesis 1, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God saw the light that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. Now, this is not necessarily daylight from nighttime. I think it's just making a comparison between light per se versus darkness. How do you understand that?
Well, you know, in my opinion, this whole series of statements are really a series of visions that Moses, being a man, had through the eyes of a man from an earthly perspective.
Okay.
Okay?
Yes.
The separation of light from darkness, it could signify a vision of the creation of an atmosphere, and if you want to see a planet, you're not going to see the light unless it has an atmosphere that reflects the light, that contains the light.
Yes. Yes.
And that could be one explanation of this.
Yes.
It's not important to me at all because this is not a scientific treatise.
That's right.
This is a series of visions that a man wrote down. Just like, even though Daniel foresaw four empires in his vision of the beast in Daniel chapter 2, he didn't write a history about them ahead of time. He only drew a picture of them.
Right.
This is the picture of creation drawn by Moses.
Right, right. And certainly, the reason I'm bringing this up is because we have this group called creationists who want to literally say that these are six literal days, 24-hour days, okay? But the problem is that the sun does not make its appearance until verse, let's see, where is it here?
The fourth day. It's
It doesn't make, the sun doesn't appear until the fourth day. So the first 3 days didn't even have a sun and stars.
Right. That entire, you know, in the mainstream world, in mainstream society, you're offered two alternatives.
Right.
The Jewish alternative
and the other Jewish alternative.
Basically, yeah. You're either a 10-billion-year-old Earth and evolution, which is not entirely true, but it's not entirely false.
Yeah.
Or a creation by a creating God.
Yes.
And a six-day creation.
Right.
That had to happen 4,000 years ago.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's not entirely true.
Yeah.
And it's certainly not false.
So the truth is somewhere in between those two.
Absolutely.
Yes.
It's the creation of this planet, of this universe, of this solar system is a very gradual thing. It probably did happen over billions of years.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. We, as a race, have only been here for 7,000, 7,500 years, and that's why our biblical chronology only goes back that far.
Right.
When I say 7,500 years, I'm using the Septuagint chronology, by the way, not the faulty Masoretic text.
Right. Why don't you go into the reason for that, because I'm sure a lot of people are not familiar with that. Why is the Septuagint so many more thousand, about 1,500 years more?
Well, there's testimony amongst early Christians that the Jews had corrupted the ages of the patriarchs and specifically their ages when their sons were born.
Yes.
And they did that to show somehow through their Kabbalistic numerology that Yahshua was not the Christ because he didn't come at the appointed time.
Right. So according to their version of whatever prophecy, when the Messiah should have come, they doctored the text so that he wouldn't come at the right time.
Right.
Okay.
And under the Masoretic text, which almost all our Bibles are based on,
yes,
the flood would be like maybe 2345 B.C.,
uh-huh,
and the creation of Adam by Usher, by Bishop Usher's count, the popular count,
yes,
would be about 4002 or 4004 B.C.
Right.
In the Septuagint, the flood of Noah would be more like 3245 B.C.
Okay.
And the creation of Adam would be approximately 5407 B.C. or something very close to that.
Okay, so roughly 55 or 54. Okay.
And we have this on the Internet. I posted a document to Clifton Emmaheiser's website at emmaheiser.christogenia.org. And you go to the home page and you look down the left-hand column to chronology, and you'll see charts with the numbers and a graphical representation of the chronology of the Septuagint as compared to the Masoretic text.
Right. Okay. So the creationists have a major problem when they confront the Septuagint, because it's not 6,000 years.
True.
Yeah. And so creationists never refer to the Septuagint. They rely on the Masoretic text, the corrupted Jewish version. Okay. All right, very good. So they're even within the extant text between the Masoretic and the Septuagint, we have a conflict as to exactly how many thousands of years this planet has existed, okay, or this world order. It's probably the best way of putting it. Okay?
Well, you see, the chronology can only come from Genesis 1:26 and the creation of Adam forward.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The chronology can't go back before that. The basic argument that I would have with the creationist is how many years are between,
yes,
Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:27.
Right.
That or Genesis 1:26.
Yeah.
That would be the problem.
Well, it's only 4 days.
and then we have to define just who Genesis 1:26 through 28 are talking about.
That's right.
Because if you include Cro-Magnon and Neanderthal man in there.
Okay.
Well, then there's many missing years in our chronology.
Yes.
And second, that would push their Adam back 30,000, 50,000, 100,000 years.
Right, exactly.
Guess seven. Can't possibly be done.
Guess seven wants to know the address of the website you just, with the ages.
It's Emmaheiser, Emmaheiser. Dot Christogenia.
Genia, yes. Okay.
Yes, Christogenia.
Yeah.
.org.
Yes, okay. All right. Now
I'm going to write window. I'll type it into the forum.
Okay, great. I'm going to quote from verse 11 here now. And God said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb yielding seed, and the fruit tree yielding fruit after his kind. Okay. Stress, underline, after his kind. Now, first of all, that word his is a bad translation. It should be its. And I researched this in Cruden's Concordance, which is one of the earlier concordances. And he says that the English language at the time that the King James was translated did not have a neuter pronoun such as its. That's why they chose his, okay? And this also bears upon Genesis 3:15, because a lot of people assume that his only means Jesus Christ, where it's talking about the offspring of Eve, okay? It's the same word. Mistranslated, should be its. It should be its kind or its seed. And that's what's going on. That's why the word his is in there instead of the neuter its, okay? Whose seed, and of course seed is talking about offspring. It's not a singular noun, it's a collective singular. Taking many individuals as a group or as a whole. And so that's why this should be neuter. Okay, so let me start from the beginning, verse 11. And God said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb yielding seed, and the fruit tree yielding fruit after its kind, whose seed is in itself, okay, there's itself, upon the earth, and it was so. Verse 12. And the earth brought forth grass and herb and seed after its kind. It should be its there, folks. And the tree yielding fruit whose seed was in itself, confirming itself in itself, after its kind. And God saw that it was good. And the evening and the morning were the third day. And so we have this numerous times. The Bible is saying after his kind, after his kind, after his kind, stressing that these species reproduce according to their own genetic code. Isn't that how you see it?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And there, and
that's a very important, frequently stated part of Scripture, idea in Scripture.
Right, right. And so those who believe that race mixing is good ignore Genesis chapter 1, which is telling us things should reproduce after their own kind. And it shouldn't be mixed up and shouldn't be hybridized. In fact, the Bible stresses in many places that we shouldn't even have, when we cultivate crops, we shouldn't cultivate two different crops next to each other, and we shouldn't mix horses and donkeys, et cetera, et cetera. So we have very specific rules against interbreeding and hybridization, okay? So we find out that let me jump to verse 24 here. And God said, let the earth bring forth the living creatures after its kind, or after their kind it really should be, and cattle and creeping thing and beast of the earth after its kind, and it was so. Now, this word beast is one of the most misunderstood words in the Scriptures. Do you have any thoughts on this word beast?
Well, it's clear in other parts of the Bible that the beast here has to describe certain bipeds that are today errantly called men.
Okay.
And there's a reference. There are beasts with hands. There were two beast creations related in Genesis, a fifth-day creation and a sixth-day creation.
Yes.
And there's only one creation of man, and that's Adamic man.
Right.
None of the other races are created by Yahweh in Genesis chapter 1 and called men.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Right. I don't, yes. Mm-hmm.
The only place you could squeeze the other races, non-Adamic men, and say that perhaps Yahweh created them is in the classification of beasts.
Yes.
Because in Genesis chapter 1, you're an Adam or you're a beast.
Right.
There's no other categories.
Yes.
There's no yellow man. There's no black man. There's only beasts and there's Adam man,
mm-hmm.
period. And there are examples of beasts throughout Scripture that have hands,
right,
just like men, and have the power of cognizance,
right,
power of thought. And some of those examples are Genesis 9:5.
Okay.
Where the hand of every beast I'll punish, you know, basically any beast for the blood of man, for the blood of Adam. The beast will peck you. Now, if a wild wolf tears an Adamite apart, the wild wolf is only acting like a wolf.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not going to take the wild wolf and stone it.
Right.
In Leviticus chapter 20, verses 15 and 16, it tells us that if a man or a woman, in this case, lies with the beast.
Yes.
That the woman or the man and the beast should be put to death.
Right.
And I don't think there was a problem with women sleeping with goats and horses.
That's right.
I don't think that's what it's talking about.
No, no.
In Hebrews 12:20, Paul says that if any beast touches the mountain, thrust it through with a dart. I don't think that means that if a little squirrel climbs up the side of a mountain,
yeah,
you put the little squirrel to death.
Of course, the mountain is the mountain of Israel.
I was just going to make that point.
Okay.
I think the mountain is representative of the people of Israel.
Right.
And if a beast touches it, well, we're to do what Phinehas did and run it through with a spear.
Right.
And
right.
I think that's what Paul was alluding to in Hebrews 12:20.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
These beasts with hands and speech that can have sex with men and women if you're a biped and you're not an Adamite, you're a beast.
Yes.
There's no other choice. There's no other alternative.
Yeah, it's and certainly in the Middle Ages, when white Europeans went down to Africa and saw how blacks were living there, they referred to those people as savages.
Absolutely.
They didn't refer to them as human beings.
And they weren't trying to dress them in our clothes and drag them.
No, they weren't. And they were serving missionaries on a plate.
So, in Romans chapter 5,
okay,
Paul defines man. And I recommend anybody wants to know what a man is, go read Romans chapter 5.
Okay.
Man is defined as Adam.
All right.
The first man, Adam. If you're not a descendant of Adam, you're a beast.
Yeah.
If you're only partly descended from Adam, you're a mamzer. You're a mongrel.
Mm-hmm.
There's no alternative.
Right.
That's
right.
The way it is. That's the facts of Scripture.
Right, right. And so this term beast, in fact, can refer. Now, let me do the word study here, because it in Genesis 1:25, in 1:24, and Genesis 1:25, the word beast is translated from the Hebrew word chay or chayah, okay? And that word, let me give you the definitions. It means alive, hence raw flesh, fresh as a plant or water or year, strong, and as a noun, especially in the feminine singular and the masculine plural, it simply means life or living thing, whether literally or figuratively. So we find out that this word che has a wide variety of meanings, just about all of them having to do with life. Okay, there's more here. Alive, appetite, wild beast. Okay, that's the translation the KJV translators chose. But the very next one, the next two, are company and congregation. Okay, now company and congregation, certainly a congregation leads you to believe it's a congregation of human beings. Okay. And then further down, it says Mary and multitude. And also, we find that when Adam decided to give Eve her name, the name Eve is based on this word, chaya, okay? And therefore, chaya can refer to, you know, what the scientists refer to as featherless bipeds, which is the point that you've just been making, okay? So if Eve is a featherless biped, certainly some of these, you know, individuals and some of these races in Genesis 1:24 and 1:25 are also Che, okay, which proves that the Che people, the non-Adamic people, were already here before Adam and Eve were created in Genesis chapter 1, verse 26, which I'll read right now. And God said, let us make man, okay? Man is translated from the Hebrew word Adam, which means to show blood in the face. Let me repeat. And God said, let us make Adam in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea. Now, only the Adamites were given dominion. The Che people, who we created before, were not given dominion, okay? Over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. And let me recite verse 27 as well. So God created Adam, that is Adam, that's the word for our race, to show blood in the face, in his own image. In the image of God created he him, male and female created he them. Okay, so it's not saying about the previous Che creatures that they were created in his image, only the Adamites were. Is that how you understand it?
Absolutely. Only the race of Adam was created in the image of God, of Yahweh.
Exactly, exactly.
No doubt. And that's found in the New Testament over and over again.
Right, right.
And it can be clearly demonstrated that the race of Adam encompasses only white people.
Right, right. Now, let's get back. I want to get back to Lucifer and Satan, because I think this is my opinion on what the Bible story is all about. And you know, started out the show by giving this scenario, and I agree with your scenario 100%. I just want to add a little more detail to how I think all of this, what's actually being played out here, and what the Bible is trying to tell us. Okay, so we had the rebellion in heaven, which was started by Lucifer, and Yahweh had predestinated the Adamic race, the Adamic people, us, to come into play, having anticipated this rebellion on the part of Lucifer. In other words, when Yahweh created the universe and he created free will beings, he understood that at some point there would be a rebellion, possibly a high-level rebellion, which would be Lucifer, and that when this rebellion occurred, which is necessitated, not necessarily necessitated, but made possible by the fact that we have free will, okay? Once he created beings that had free will, he also created the possibility of rebellion, okay? In anticipation of all this, he had predestinated the Adamic race to take the place of the fallen beings who are led by Lucifer / Satan, okay? And so when they had fallen to the earth, as you mentioned in Revelation chapter 12, that's actually talking about this rebellion up in heaven. And when they were cast down to the earth, they had a temporary dominion here on planet earth. And when Yahweh created the Adamites, he created the Adamites in order to take their place because of their rebellion. That's how I see it. Is that how you see it?
Yes, almost in that language.
Okay.
I brought this up before and didn't quite get the chance to finish it.
Okay.
I don't like to use the term Lucifer. I know it says in Isaiah, I think it's 14:12. O Lucifer, son of the morning. That's the only place that appears in the Bible.
Okay.
And it's the only time that the fall of Satan is mentioned, as far as I can remember, in the Old Testament.
Okay.
A lot of the fault that the anti-two seed liners give to our doctrine is that it's not found in the Old Testament.
Okay.
And there are many statements in the New Testament saying that Yahshua Christ, and Paul supports this, came to reveal things kept secret from the foundation of the society.
Right.
Not the world. The
right.
Society. Which didn't happen in Genesis 1:1. It happened in Genesis 1:26.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
Now, when you go into the all right, Revelation 12 equates Satan, the serpent,
mm-hmm.
the dragon,
yeah.
all is the same entity.
Exactly.
I don't see it as, I don't like to use the word Lucifer, because it gives the connotation that we're talking about an individual.
Okay.
One particular individual, and people, and especially people from churchianity, they come to take that as one particular spirit being that goes around and whispers over our shoulders
right.
and seduces us. And
well, that is what Nahash does.
Do. Yeah. Well, yeah,
he's
but Nahash has two legs, and they walk around in Armani suits.
Right. At least today they do, yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right.
The Lucifer, the word means light bearer.
Okay.
And Satan is surely the light bearer.
Yeah.
Just turn the television on.
That's right.
Christians are sitting in darkness staring at the light.
That's right. That's right. If thy light be darkness, that's how
so
Jesus puts it.
So it's a very apt description of the enemy,
yeah.
Lucifer.
Yes. But what I was trying to get is the concept of predestination of the Adamite people.
Absolutely, right.
That's what I'm getting at. It's a predestination. It has nothing to do. Certainly, there's only one race that's predestinated for this purpose, and another.
Absolutely, and that's why Adam was created.
Yes,
the entire Bible is a book about Adam.
Yes.
From beginning to end. Paul defines man as Adam man in Romans 5. We cannot take anything else We cannot add the other races to that.
Yes.
By any means.
Right, right.
We have in Jude a description of angels that lost their first estate.
Okay.
And that left their first estate. These angels that left in their first estate are the same people spoken about in 2 Peter,
mm-hmm.
chapter 2. Okay?
Yes.
And 2 Peter describes these people in much the same way that Jude does.
Yes.
They are committed, they are connected very strongly by Jude with the act of fornication.
Yes.
Which is the pursuit of strange flesh.
Mm-hmm.
And Jude
mm-hmm.
goes on to enumerate Cain, Balaam, Korah, and connects them all to the same error.
Right.
Error of race mixing.
That's right.
Fornication is the pursuit of strange flesh, is race mixing. We could probably talk about that one word for an hour, and I'm not going to go there tonight.
Right, right.
However, all of this is connected to the angels which left their first estate in Jude and in 2 Peter. We have 2 biblical witnesses to this right in the New Testament.
Yes.
Now, where is this coming from? It's coming from 1 Enoch. And if you go read the same parts of 1 Enoch that Jude is quoting.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, if you just take Jude's quote, which is it's in 1 Enoch, and it's probably chapter 15. I can pull it up here in a
okay.
second.
Yeah, and
it's in 1 Enoch 15, verses 4 to 12.
Okay.
Now, I'm going to pick up right from where Jude left off.
Okay.
Okay? And from where we left off with Jude's discussion, right after that, in 1 Enoch 15:4, it says, "And though ye were holy, spiritual, living eternal life," and he's talking to the fallen angels.
Right.
"You have defiled yourselves with the blood of women, and have begotten children with the blood of the flesh."
Which is Genesis chapter 6.
Referring to Genesis chapter 6.
Exactly.
"And have..."
You're reading my mind.
"...blood of flesh."
Yes.
"And as the children of men have lusted after flesh and blood, as those also who die and perish, therefore I have given them wives also that they might impregnate them and beget children by them, and that thus nothing might be wanting to them on earth. But you," meaning the fallen angels,
mm-hmm.
"were formerly spiritual, living the eternal life and immortal for all generations of the world, and therefore I have not appointed wives for you, as the spiritual ones of the heaven, in heaven is their dwelling."
Yes.
And then it goes on to discuss the giants who are produced from the spirits and flesh,
mm-hmm.
fallen angels, and the flesh, Genesis chapter 6, "shall be called evil spirits upon the earth, and on the earth shall be their dwelling. Evil spirits have proceeded from their bodies." And I'm reading this from my essay, it's on my website, "The Problem with Genesis 6, 1 to 4.
Okay.
And in it, I go in, I quote the Book of Enoch, I quote the Genesis Apocryphon, I cite the Dead Sea Scrolls, certain Dead Sea Scrolls. "The evil spirits, the wicked spirits, are the spirits of bastards, the
yeah.
spirits of beasts of mixed race."
Mm-hmm.
That's where the evil spirits in the world come from that we see in the New Testament.
Yes, yes.
And they were pretty much bound by Christ
mm-hmm.
at the cross. And that's why they're not evident to us today.
Right, right, right. As much.
Now, well, yeah.
Yeah.
We still have the physical ones, though.
Right.
Running around.
Exactly.
We're going to get into all of this.
But let me stop you right there, because that's a big wad to chew on right there. And I agree with 100% of what you just said. And so what we're saying is that these fallen angels took embodied shape, which was actually not intended for them. And probably one of the reasons was somehow they got wind of, or had knowledge of, or perception of the pleasures of sexuality and all of the other pleasures and I'm sure pains of living in the flesh. And they saw this and desired to partake of it, and this desire caused them to fall. Is that kind of what's going on here?
Absolutely. I'd like to talk for a few minutes on this, and I'll try
okay.
to give an overview.
Okay.
we have in the apocryphal literature that these fallen angels went out, and it's in Enoch, it's explicit.
Mm-hmm.
I cite it in my writing.
Yes.
They went out and they confused all manner of beasts. They mixed their seed with every form of beast.
Right.
Now, we have a lot of bipeds in the world today.
Yes.
and they didn't all exist longer than 25, 30, 40,000 years ago.
Okay.
Okay, a lot of these types of man did not exist in the form that they're in presently.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we have Neanderthal man and Cro-Magnon man and a whole lot of other men that we've
humanoids.
Got around in anthropology that aren't here anymore.
Right.
And we have a period in the prehistory of our race where several species of biped, apparently intelligent, so I'll call them men, even though that's not my definition of the term man.
Right. Well, I use the word humanoid to distinguish it from Adamites.
Humanoid is a good word.
Yes.
We have these people came and went. They may have been here maybe 30, 40, 80, 100,000 years, not much longer than that, and they're gone.
Yeah.
And who were they? Now, Neanderthal man has a larger skull capacity, a larger cranial capacity than we do.
Mm-hmm.
Out of all the races currently on the earth, the white man has by far the largest cranial capacity and therefore the most, the highest degree of learning and culture and creation, creative skills.
Creative thinking, yes. Okay.
Right. All come from us. Everything invented in the world has basically come from us.
Yes. It all came from Europe.
Well, Neanderthal man had a larger brain than we do.
Okay.
Are they the fallen angels? I'm just throwing that out there. I don't know. I'm not going to claim to know anything.
Right.
I just know that we have all these forms of humanoids before us, and they're gone, and there's really no reason for it, and now no explanation for it, I mean, and no recorded history of it.
Right. Well, actually, that may not be true because the people of Gath, which were one of the Canaanite tribes, was a tribe of giants that stemmed back to these fallen angels mating with Adamite women in Genesis chapter 6.
Yes, they were actually the Gathites. Gath was a Philistine city. I wouldn't call the Philistines themselves Canaanites.
Right.
But it's clear from Scripture that there were Rephaim.
Right.
The Philistines.
Yes.
And we have a valley of the giants where the Rephaim dwelt in Palestine at the time of the children of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And this is clear that these are leftovers from the Genesis 6 account.
Right.
Because the Rephaim can be connected in Scripture to the Nephilim.
That's right.
And the word Rapha in Hebrew means giant.
Yes. Yes.
And we have in Chronicles the description of Goliath and his brothers, and it says explicitly that they're sons of Rapha,
right?
Who is the giant.
Exactly.
Ha-Rapha means the giant.
Now, it's evident to me that a lot of these mythological beings, such as satyrs, which are half goat and half human, and what's the centaur, I believe, is the half human, half horse. It's evident to me that these fallen angels, as you were just trying to explain, were engaged in not just in race mixing, but also in genetic experimentation. And there is evidence in the Bible of that when the Israelites first scouted out the land of the Rephaim. They said, well, these people we're like grasshoppers in their sight. And then they brought up some grapes that were as big as watermelons practically. Now, where do you get grapes as big as watermelons? They had to, bunch of them had to be carried by two men on a stick.
There's absolutely no doubt that the work Monsanto does today is not original.
That's right. That's right. They're doing the same thing today that the Rephaim did then.
And there are stories in Greek mythology and amongst the Assyrians and the Babylonians.
Right.
Of many half and half creatures.
Yes. Yeah.
The satyrs are half man and half goat.
Right. Right. And so it's pretty evident that there was conscious, not just race mixing, but conscious genetic manipulation going on. And if these fallen angels, obviously if they fell from heaven, they were pretty intelligent. And they probably knew how to engage in genetic manipulation. And all these things combined were exactly what Yahweh hated and detested and caused the Noah's flood for. Isn't that right?
That's absolutely true.
Mm-hmm.
And that genetic manipulation is not, it's not explicitly put in those terms in the apocryphal literature,
mm-hmm.
but you can surely infer it from the apocryphal literature.
Yes.
They went out and they mingled themselves and the seed of every species.
Yeah. And certainly we don't have grapes that are the size of watermelons anymore.
It would be my contention that all of the other races, the non-Adamic races, the non-white races in the world today who engage in all sorts of wicked practices, serpent worship,
yes.
voodoo priests, voodoo witch doctors, they admit that they're Satan's representatives on Earth.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Certain Oriental tribes have no qualms about their serpent worship and their lusts for destruction.
Yes.
All of these people had to either be the products of this fallen angel mingling, this fallen race that went out and confused all of the beast creation.
Yes.
And they're the product of that. So they are, therefore, part of the generic term that's used that I consider to be the adversary or Satan.
Right, right. So, but the important thing in terms of presenting an alternative to the mainstream view of Genesis 1 through 3 is that we have to understand that all these races were already here on this planet. The idea that all of the various races came from Adam, Eve, and Nahash, or just from Adam and Eve, is just absurd.
It is absolutely absurd. And now the spin that the evolutionists have, they try to use mitochondrial DNA, and the whole theory falls apart very easily under close inspection.
Yeah.
But they try to use mitochondrial DNA to prove that we somehow descended from these other races.
Yeah.
Because they know, and they know that this is very clear in the anthropological record.
Yes.
That the white man is the newest species on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we appeared here last, and that's what the book of Genesis says. We were made last.
We were made
at the end of Genesis chapter 1.
And agriculture didn't come until the white man came.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Everything didn't come until the white man came.
Recorded history.
The Greeks have myths that talk about temples built by the gods.
Yes.
And there are ancient stone cities, the walls of the cities that the Greeks had moved into. They didn't build, and they tell us that. They moved
mm-hmm.
into them.
Yes.
They didn't build them. And huge stone platforms, and we have the stone temples
right.
of Corfu and some of the islands around the Mediterranean that are before our historic recollection.
Yes.
We have no idea where these things came from.
Yeah. And the creationists, they ignore the fact that with their assumption of being 4004 BC being the creation date. Now, the fact is there are layers of archaeological remains predating 4000 BC and they can't explain where they came from.
Well, it's absolutely clear that we have, back to the flood, we have a pretty good sketch of history in the remains of our own records.
Yes.
Our own inscriptions, our own books. We can go back that far.
At least
back to 3000 BC.
Yeah, yeah.
From what we've dug out of the ground that we know belongs to us, and we can identify these people that this stuff we dug up belonged to.
Yes, yes.
And it's clear that there were many findings and many things much older than that we cannot explain.
Yes, yes. And certainly the creationists can't explain them.
And predecessors are not necessarily forebears.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big confusion. They'll find something 10,000 years old in England, and they'll automatically assume that it came from the ancestors of the English.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just crazy.
Yeah.
Because we know that there's nothing on the North American continent that came from our direct ancestors that's more than 500 years old.
Right.
that I noticed that I'm not talking about the evidence of European presence here before that, but I mean the archaeological findings in Mexico of Aztec people.
Mm-hmm.
Just because they were here before us doesn't mean they're our ancestors. That's the point I'm trying to make.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's just crazy. If it's found in Europe, it must have belonged to 20,000-year-old white people.
Right.
Well, it didn't.
Mm-hmm.
That's just simply not.
Well, it's a separate creation or a special formation, however you want to put it, by Yahweh. And it's the Adamic race, okay, which came later. And the other races were already here.
Absolutely.
Yes, okay.
The our race is the newest race here, and the basic point I'm trying to make is that because mainstream scientists know that, they're trying to use mitochondrial DNA theory, which is shot full of holes, and they insist that it's true, and the media's taken that football and run with it,
mm-hmm.
to prove that white people descended from the other races.
Right,
which is just crazy.
Yeah, there's no proof of that. It's just, even if it were scientific, it's still nothing but guesswork, which makes it less than scientific. Yeah, go ahead.
I could talk about mitochondrial DNA at
length. Oh, okay,
but
sure.
It wouldn't be... it's not. I'd rather move on with this.
Right. Let me go to Genesis chapter 2. I'm going to quote the verses 16 through 19. And Yahweh Elohim commanded the man, of course he's speaking to Adam, directly to Adam, saying, of every tree of the garden thou mayest freely eat, but of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Now this can't be a literal tree in this case here, okay? Because the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, thou shalt not eat of it. And here he's giving Adam law, okay? He's telling him that this you can't do, this you can do. For in the day that thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die. Which means he was created to be immortal, okay? Verse 18. And Yahweh Elohim said, it is not good that the man should be alone. I will make him an helpmeet for him. And out of the ground, Yahweh Elohim formed every beast of the field. There's that beast of the field again. And every fowl of the air, and brought them unto Adam to see what he could call them. And whatsoever Adam called every living creature, that was the name thereof. In other words, Adam was the first botanist. He gave names to all these things.
Yes, absolutely. This is the beginning of our race, and somebody had to give these things names.
Right. It's the beginning of science.
That we spoke.
Yes, it's the beginning of science, the beginning of civilization, etc.
Absolutely.
And that's what this is telling us. These things did not happen until Adam was here, folks. Civilization and the historical record proves it. Agriculture came into being with the Adamites. Science came into being with the Adamites before the Adamites were put into the garden by Yahweh. We had, as we discussed earlier, what's the term? A hunter-gatherer society on this planet, and nothing better.
Right. There were no creative arts that were technical.
Mm-hmm.
We have cave paintings that are 30,000 years old, no doubt.
Yeah.
But there were no creative arts as we know them today. No, there were only crude drawings and crude tool making.
Yes. Let's see. I see we've only got about 10 minutes left. I just want to quickly jump to Josephus, Antiquities of the Judahites, Chapter 2, in talking about Cain, because we've been talking about race mixing and hybridization. Here is what Josephus has to say about Cain and Abel. Chapter 2, verse 1, paragraph 1. Adam and Eve had two sons. The elder of them was named Cain, which name, when it is interpreted, signifies a possession. The younger was Abel, which signifies sorrow. That's his interpretation. They had also daughters. Now the two brethren were pleased with different courses of life. For Abel, the younger, was a lover of righteousness, and believing that God was present at all his actions, he excelled in virtue, and his employment was that of a shepherd. So Josephus is also stating that there was law, because you don't have righteousness without law. But Cain was not only very wicked in other respects, but was wholly intent upon getting, and he first contrived to plow the ground. Okay? He uses the word contrived when he's talking about Cain plowing the ground. He slew his brother on the occasion following. They had resolved to sacrifice to God. Now Cain brought the fruits of the earth and of his husbandry. Okay, he just brought any old fruit, okay? But Abel brought milk and the first fruits of his flocks, okay? Which is reminiscent of the first fruits of the Israelites, okay? So Abel brought the first fruits, Cain did not. But God was more delighted with the latter oblation when he was honored with what grew naturally of its own accord than he was with what was the invention of a covetous man and gotten by forcing the ground. Isn't this talking about hybridization?
Well, it seems to be, and Clifton believes it is, and forcing the ground
yes.
would certainly seem to refer to hybridization. I'm not going to argue that point. I'm not even going to, I would
challenge.
Have to agree with that to a great extent, so I'm not going to challenge it.
Okay.
Even though I don't espouse it directly.
Yeah, okay, but it's interesting that Josephus has this perspective, which
right.
is lacking. Yeah.
Josephus, I have to remark about Josephus's perspective. His learning is the learning of the Pharisees of
okay.
the time of Christ.
Right, okay.
He was 5 years old at the crucifixion, Josephus.
Uh-huh.
And he was raised, apart from Christianity, in traditional Judaism.
Okay.
And this is his entire interpretation of Scripture is representative of the learning of the Pharisees.
Okay. Okay.
And it's not entirely valid.
Yeah.
In fact, he thought, for instance, that Cain was Adam's son.
Okay.
Taking Genesis 4:1 at face value.
Right, right.
By the way, the meaning of Cain's own name infers that he's not Adam's son because his name means possession.
Right.
You don't call your real son a possession.
Right. Right, and it also means covetousness. And, in fact, Cain, I forget the exact Hebrew, we can get into that next week when I'm going to start pulling out more word studies. But, yes, Cain was definitely, as Josephus is trying to tell us, a remarkably different type of person from Abel.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and there has to be a reason for that.
It's genetic.
Yes, it's genetic.
It's the only explanation. The entire separation of Cain and Abel can only be explained by genetics.
Right, right.
Cain's genealogy given in Genesis chapter 4, not the Adam not being a part of it, that can only be explained because of the genetic problem.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, Adam, when your wife gets pregnant, this is they had different standards in the ancient world. If your wife got pregnant by somebody else, she's not your wife. Now she's somebody else's wife.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, Adam took her to himself,
yes.
and he ate too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, when he did that, he accepted Cain as his.
Yes. Okay.
So legally, Cain became his son, even if Cain is not his genetic son.
So by adoption, in other words.
And we have an exact parallel in the story of Mary and Joseph.
Okay, yes.
Joseph was told by the angel of God, hey, don't worry about this. This comes from Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
This is the plan. And Joseph is a great man of faith and accepted that.
Yes.
And accepted Yahshua Christ as his own son. And therefore, Yahshua Christ inherited the throne of David on that technicality.
Right, right. So in other words, Yahweh reversed the process of what happened in the garden.
Absolutely.
Yes. He reversed the process.
It's an absolute reversal of the process.
Mm-hmm. And that fulfills what Jesus said in the parable of the wheat and the tares. When the servants, the farm workers said, hey, what are all these tares doing in the field? And his answer was, an enemy has planted them.
Absolutely. We could go to 20 places in the New Testament and show that Cain is not Adam's son.
Right.
That is how the enemy, that's the first infiltration by the enemy.
That's right.
Is what this represents. All of Genesis 3
mm-hmm.
is a parable, and it's about infiltration, and it's about our own and solicitor. It's about our own lust and desires and what happens when we cave into them.
Yes, yes. Well, I wanted to quote Genesis 2:22 to the end, but there's not enough time to talk about these three verses or four verses. Let's pick up our conversation next time at the end of Genesis chapter 2, and then we'll get into the juicy stuff, Genesis chapter 3, and we'll discuss all the ramifications of what's going on in Genesis chapter 3, and especially Genesis 3:15, where we have to get a proper understanding, because this is the first prophecy in the Bible, and it prophesies an enmity, a hatred between the offspring of Eve and the offspring of Nahash, whose first son was Cain. Isn't that how you see it?
Absolutely.
Right.
We've only scratched the surface tonight.
We
just have a lot of ground to cover yet.
Right, exactly. But so let's pick up, let me make a mark here. Genesis chapter 2, actually go to verse 21. And we'll finish off Genesis chapter 2 with those five or six verses at the end of chapter 2. And then we'll get into chapter 3 and we'll explain why the two seed line position is the only correct interpretation of Genesis chapter 3. Okay?
Yes, absolutely.
All right, excellent. Okay, I think we've covered a lot of ground this evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's going to get even more interesting when we pick up this story, and we definitely want to get into Genesis chapter 4 and talk about the offspring of Cain. And the Bible does tell us that there is a bloodline descending through Cain and a bloodline descending through Adam and Eve. Only one group is Adamites. The other are Canaanites, folks. And we will document exactly how the Bible differentiates between those two groups of people, those two bloodlines. So thanks for joining us this evening. First installment of the two seed line to theory explained. Next Friday night, we'll pick up on rest of chapter 2, part 2 of this discussion. We'll probably get in two more episodes on this theme. So thanks, Bill, for being my guest this evening. And let's do this again next Friday night. In the meantime, Yahweh bless everybody.
Yahweh bless. Praise Yahweh.
Bye-bye.